Please welcome new SAA President Frank Bowles.
I'm wondering if any of you listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You're way ahead of me, aren't you? It's a new fundraiser for $10. We don't have Carl, but on your machine. Thank you all for coming. We are very appreciative you can be here. I'm looking for Mark Green. Is he out there somewhere? Is he just... Somebody's pointing. There's Mr. Mark. Hi, Mark. I had scripted a few comments regarding Mark. Yeah, he's. But Mark, I'm going to assure you that after what Dennis did to you, there's nothing I can do that's worse. So I'm simply going to say, we on council, myself personally, are all going to miss Mark terribly. He has been a wonderful president. He has been a wonderful leader of council. He has served you and the society with extraordinary vigor and vision. And I am very, very grateful for his service and just terrified to have to follow him. Thank you, Mark. It is also my pleasure at this meeting to greet our friend, Ellen Weinstein, the Archivist of the United States, who has spoken to us many times, and I am thrilled and happy that he has had the opportunity to join us here in San Francisco. And I'm going to ask him to step to the podium to make a few remarks. Dr. Weinstein?
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. What happened at this convention was very unusual in my life since becoming Archivist of the United States. And that was that I went to the convention. I started out Wednesday. It's now Saturday. I have to go back, darn it. But this was a wonderful event for me, and I want to thank all of you for this extraordinary convention. It's been a while since I've seen rooms as jam-packed with excited people and fresh ideas and fresh concerns. And it really works. So thank you very much for your hospitality. Thank Nancy Beaumont for her hospitality. Thank Frank. Thank your predecessor, if we can find him, Mark. But most importantly, thank all of you. And I want to start out with a few announcements, which is kind of weird for someone who is a guest of this group. But there have been a few news-related items that I would like to at least leave an update with you. For example, Anthony Clark. The name Anthony Clark means something to some of you because he's the young scholar who seems to have been given a hard time by some of my colleagues in NARA in terms of researching papers having to do internally to the work of NARA. He should not have had a hard time. I've straightened that out. He's getting access to everything he wants to look at, everything he wants to look at, and that's all being processed for him now. And then the little glitch came along yesterday and somebody decided maybe the archivist doesn't really know what he's doing. And so we went through a little crease which lasted all of about 5 minutes. But Mr. Clark is in good hands. If there are any other additional problems, I'll deal with them. But I just want you to know that for those who brought this to my attention, I mean, a bunch of you have. And then we come to Mr. John Dean. I know I can get a lamp by just mentioning Mr. John Dean here, but it was a very lively address. I enjoyed listening to him, enjoyed chatting with him. But I didn't enjoy, I suppose, very candidly, was hearing Mr. Dean, to great applause, criticize the new director of the Nixon Library, a very fine young historian named Timothy Naftali. And criticizing Naftali, if you're going to believe this, for permitting a writer with a controversial book from appearing at the Nixon Library. My God, what was there so much about the controversy? No matter how wrong-headed it may have been, that we had to keep it from having an appearance and having no say. Isn't the point of all of our presidential libraries, including the Nixon Library, especially the Nixon Library, to provide the broadest possible opportunities for comment and controversy. And I think that's the case. Everybody's views should have the ability to be expressed, including Mr. Dean's. So I will forgive him this once. In fact, I'll invite him to the Nixon Library. And, never again. Okay, let's get down to business. How can we get down to business? Ah, here it is. And the page number I'm dealing with is page 3. That doesn't work. This is San Francisco, correct? The SAA program describes this session as one which addresses perspectives on the issues that the profession faces in the coming years. The topic is not new to me. Even at my Senate confirmation hearings in July of 2004, I was asked to review the challenges I would confront as an archivist. At that time, I outlined a list of priorities that included familiar and obvious ones today, like the following: reducing the enormous backlog in processing and making available to the public the 9 billion plus documents and other materials under the National Archives oversight at our Washington facilities and throughout NARA's facilities elsewhere in the country, in the presidential libraries, regional archives, etc. Now, I tried, half whimsically at one point, to ban the word backlog in favor of discussing what I'd like to call at the time NARA's surplus, surplus of documents. It sounds better, but which remains, of course, but in an obvious way, as intractable a problem as it was after decades of diminished budgets and cuts, staff cuts. It's a real problem. Shortly after I became archivist, 2 or 3 weeks into that, I have a solution to this problem, though. My person introducing was on this stage, and she said, "Now, I'm very anxious for you to meet the alchemist of the United States, Alan Weinstein." True story. And so I'm going to use that. What I did with her was take my pen out, point it in her direction, and say, "Shazam." There was some words. My magic did not work then, but I'm working on that. And I'm taking a course. So hopefully, when my magic has reached that bon point, then I can find some way of dealing with the backlog, surplus, or whatever it is. But probably not until then. Not unless Congress turns over a new leaf and gives us the money we want and need. Number two problem. Moving forward, NARA's major electronic records initiatives, including electronic records archives, yes, ERA, which recently demonstrated its initial operating capability, on a revised schedule, to be sure. Someone would have said it was a bit late, but still the first system of its kind to be stood up and to become operational. Many of you who have worked on the ERA, or in this audience, some of you, I think, have worked on the ERA, and I'd really appreciate your standing up and being acknowledged. Anybody here who worked on it? Is Ken Thibodeau here? Nobody. Congratulations to all of you. Okay. Next. Strengthening cooperation among the presidential libraries in NARA system, while at the same time continuing the development of effective liaison with state, local, and other non-governmental entities, archivists. Under the leadership at the moment, let me just say that we have a new liaison. I've been an old liaison, then I took him off that duty and made him our person who dealt with Congress for a year and did a brilliant job. He's now back on track. And where's David McCone? David, stand up, people. David was my able colleague this past year in elevating congressional support for the National Archives to record levels, and I mean record levels. We've never had anything like it. And I want to thank here the members of Congress and their staffs who have lent their support to this process. We will use the money wisely, and we will be very caring in all of that. Okay. Now, continuing the development of NARA's educational and civic literacy programs throughout all NARA facilities, including expanded support for the National Historical Publications and Records Commission programs. Under NHPRC's creative new leader, she's not here, she had to leave, but you should all get to meet Kathleen Wilson Williams, because she is doing a remarkable job. We'll probably have all of the Founding Fathers' papers available online within 3 years. Let me ask a question just out of curiosity. How many people in this audience have had an NHPRC grant? How many people in this audience have worked with those who've had NHPRC grants? Can you stand up just to give me a, or put your hands up or something so I can... It's a large number. Thank you very much for making the point. Next, strengthening cooperation among the presidential libraries in NARA's system, while at the same time I've been through that. Okay. Now, other issues, although comparably important, found no place in my confirmation testimony 4 years ago. Nobody asked me about the presidential libraries in my confirmation hearing. It was amazing to me. But the complexities of bringing in presidential libraries into the existing presidential library system, this remains an issue, a major set of issues. For example, I know the Bush business got a lot of headlines, but I did not consider the Bush library controversy to be an extraordinarily difficult controversy. It's a question of laying out the ground rules. SMU laid out the ground rules. The Bush people accepted them, and that was that. Which brings me, however, and this is all part of the dowries, what controversies accompany presidential libraries, wherever they are. But then we get to the problem of the Nixon Library, the private Nixon Library, which was a much more complicated problem in terms of its inclusion in the NARA system. I learned at some personal cost why it took over 3 decades to untangle the burdens of history and law prior to escorting the Nixon Library into the federal system. It will take some additional time, of course, to complete the assimilation process, but believe me, we're working at it. Okay. And then we had an occasional miracle. Miracles are very good if you can budget for them, but by all means do that. But in our case, we lost the presence for a time of the one copy of the Magna Carta in North America. That was a donated process from Ross Perot, who owned the thing. And we thought we were going to lose it forever. And along came our philanthropist, David Rubenstein, who basically bought the thing back and gave it to us, not as a gift, this is a loan, but we now have our copy of the Magna Carta back. Never expected it to happen. Another unanticipated set of issues for the archives, National Archives, was, in some dramatic new fashion, programming in the international sphere. This has been, you had an expanded program of cooperation with our Canadian colleagues, including a joint Washington-Ottawa pair of exhibits on the 1783 Treaty of Paris. It also included cooperation among all of the major democracies, updating and reforming the International Council of Archivists, and an ongoing program development involving American, Canadian, Israeli, and Palestinian archivists, a program that will take me next week to Jerusalem and Ramallah, both, 4 meetings to organize cooperative programs and archival training and mutual support between the two Middle Eastern protagonists. I'll keep reporting on this as we go forward. As for the International Council of Archivists, it celebrates its 60th anniversary this year. It's grown to 130 countries, and it receives support from all the major democracies, including ourselves. Okay. I couldn't believe it when I realized that we may have 100 people from the National Archives attending this meeting. We certainly, I could count about 60 or 70. I think there probably are others. May I ask those of you who work at the National Archives in one capacity or another to at least raise your hands? I see you've all gone home already. Well, anyway. But you were here. One vexing internal issue of major consequence for the National Archives and the entire archival community is the continued brain drain and loss of experienced staff due to retirement and compounded by aging facilities in our physical plant, deteriorating records, and unconscionable administrative backlogs. Not surprises. What stands out, however, as both challenge and achievement since becoming archivist is the key sacred mission common to all in our profession. Here I use words borrowed from my confirmation statement. As archivist, I will enforce the laws regarding access to public records at all times and instances to the very best of my ability. Where problems occur, it will be my intention to pursue solutions through dialogue and persuasion, if possible, and at the earliest possible moment. My job description is transparent. The Archivist of the United States works for the American people, indifferent to partisanship. Therefore, the archivist must display at all times a devotion to the laws and principles governing the responsibilities of the office. Moreover, the archivist serves as the designated custodian of America's essential records that defy the tooth of time. Fancy words, but are they reflected in NARA's actions? Item. Since February 2005, when I took office, more than 4.5 million pages of previously classified material have been released to public inspection. Now, I'm taking volunteers for whoever would like to count them. Recall also that 2 years ago, we at NARA shut down the then extensive practice of reclassifying materials which I discovered had previously been declassified. In that process, I put an end to secret agreements between NARA and two intelligence agencies negotiated during my predecessor's tenure, and I guarantee that none have followed, none will follow. Turning to today's issues, on which I plan to speak at length during my State of the Archives talk later this fall, I can assure this audience that as long as I remain Archivist of the United States, my senior staff and I will continue working to achieve in the end the fullest documented record possible of the current administration. A New York Times editorial writer last month complained, quoting him or her, that the National Archives need some spine stiffening. Excuse me, some spine stiffening. Really? Really? You should know that my staff has been meeting regularly with White House personnel and with the relevant leaders of Congress to encourage expedited processing of all appropriate documentation in the congressional records, in the administration's records. But one thing, however, you can be certain, the Archives has been on the case, is on the case, and will continue to be on the case. But since the National Archives is the federal government agency whose primary purpose is to support American democracy by making government records available to the public, the question becomes when subject matter experts at the various federal government agencies classify or control such information, how is it identified and protected, and when can the public gain access? The National Archives Information Security Oversight Office, ISOO, monitors the security classification program throughout the government. In addition, beginning this year, the National Archives has been charged with overseeing the implementation of a recently announced government-wide framework for managing so-called controlled unclassified information, CUI. Will there be other such programs given to the National Archives to monitor? Probably. What they are, we don't know. We know it's moving through Congress, but we're not certain when it will move through Congress and if it will move through Congress. When President Franklin Roosevelt cautioned Americans in 1933, 75 years ago, that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, he forgot to add the appropriate response. Frankly, that's plenty to fear. The National Archives has been entrusted by Congress and the executive branch, past and present, with significant responsibilities for striking the appropriate balance between defending individual rights and unfettered access to government records on the one hand, and defending on the other, at the same time, legitimate assertions of government authority to withhold some records, whether on national security or privacy grounds. As the National Archives enters its 75th year, its fundamental obligation and most demanding task remains striking the appropriate balance between protecting citizens' access rights while defending the protection of our most sensitive records. The poet Marion Moore once described this balance as portraying imaginary gardens with real toads in them, imaginary gardens in which fearmongers once identified thousands of alleged communist spies, and now as ephemerally a comparable imaginary garden filled with thousands of Islamic terrorists. However, only a far smaller number of identifiable real toads have apparently been at work, in fact, perpetuating genuine mischief against the American Republic, and many of these homegrown to boot. So we have an issue here that we have to confront. Before I've used up my time, I've abused my time, but I'm finishing up now. Don't worry, Frank. Before taking my leave, one final reminder about which, if I'm not mistaken, I have mentioned before to this group. The six phases of a project. It is fitting to describe it again today because it fits the projects that have preoccupied me as archivist of the United States. Phase one, enthusiasm. Phase two, disillusionment. Phase three, panic. Phase four, search for the guilty. Phase five, punishment of the innocent. That's an important one. Phase six, praise and honors for the non-participants. At the moment, I dangle perilously between phases four and five, searching for the guilty and punishing the innocent. Wish me luck. The work continues. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Weinstein. You may have used your time, but I assure you, you have never abused it with us. We are very grateful for you to come and take your time to share your thoughts with us. But now you're forced to listen to me. And those of you who have attended enough SAA meetings know that there's often a meter and a method to presidential addresses, which for convenience, I would divide into five parts. The presenter acknowledges his or her humility, which in my case is pretty easy since there's plenty to be humble about. The audience in the second part of the presentation is excoriated. Okay, if the president is judicious, merely mildly rebuked for its failure to perceive or act upon some professional shortcoming. A vision is presented in the third part of the program, preferably a vision calling for a sweeping professional change, After all, you only get to do this twice, at the beginning of your term and the end of your term. Why go for the bronze? And in the tradition, going back to revivalist preachers of the 19th century, in the fourth movement, the president offers a path to redemption, a way to become a better archival professional through the transformation of your professional life. I like to call this the come to Mueller, Fife, and Froon moment. The host committee gets the fifth part. The host committee for the next meeting, in this case Austin, and all host committees, always want a plug that never really fits in. In this case, giving the whole thing a Texas swing, which is pretty tough for a guy who's lived most of his life in Michigan, has always considered the phrase, you all, to be two words, and doesn't really dance. However, not to disappoint anyone, let me offer the following outline of my presentation. I do indeed promise to excoriate you for your short-sightedness, not settling for a mere judicious rebuke. I promise to offer a vision that goes for the gold. I promise to put forth a path through which the vision can be achieved, thus authoring redemption. Redemption, of course, which comes at a price, and this time a very real one. And I promise to throw in a line or two about Texas. Turning then to the humility part of the presentation, I'm reminded of the quote from Harold Ramis, who, by the way, as far as I can tell, has absolutely no connection to Texas. But if he knew what the host committee was planning, he would be in Austin in a heartbeat. Come on, host committee, let's go. That was your shameless plug, host committee. Anyway, Harold Ramis has said, came, saw, conquered, had second thoughts. I can tell you when I received the call informing me that I'd won the election, my first thought was, shouldn't they have elected someone responsible? I've got a reputation to maintain. Maybe it's not a good one like Mark's Green, but it's a reputation. My second thought was to ask for a recount. After all, I'd lived in Chicago for a bit, and last I knew, a six-pack delivered to the right time, to the right people, can have a great weight in their values, archival or otherwise. But here I am, and I do indeed go forward in the next year with a great deal of humbleness. It is both an honor and, in all candor, scary as hell to be SAA president. I will do my best so that when I leave the office this time next year, I will neither have completely dishonored myself nor dragged SAA through hell. Well, humility is a good thing, but the question forming in your mind is likely, when am I going to get done with the navel-gazing and get on with the promised excoriation? Right now. The topic of today's Jeremiad is taken from Mark's address of yesterday. Not values, since unlike Mark, I've always been rather value-challenged, but money and power, or more properly, the means to achieve both. Advocacy, specifically political advocacy. Most specifically, the limited effectiveness among archivists in carrying out political advocacy and thus obtaining money and power. Now, I expect a certain amount of resistance to this theme, but every preacher knows that the devil has hold on some that is hard to shake. And that old devil, the old devil, he's going to make some of you think, hey, wait a minute. We managed to get NHPRC funded every time the Bush administration has zeroed it out. We can't be that inept. Some will even claim that the annual fight over NHPRC is effective political advocacy. I'm here to tell you what is known by the political angels and the union hacks that I grew up with. Being zeroed out of the president's budget 4 years in a row makes archivists the poster children for how not to do business in Washington. That NHPRC is funded annually should be a given, not an annual battle. Why do we get zeroed out? We get zeroed out because we lack effective political advocacy. NHPRC funding, however, is really only one example of our political shortcomings, and to my mind, not necessarily the most important one. 5 to 10 million in the archival collection plate certainly isn't loose change. But it's also a long way from touching the life of every archivist every day in the country. Other areas of government policy and regulation do affect us daily and have a tendency to make or break what we can do. Let me suggest three examples. copyright, privacy, and the public's right to access public records. Now, let me start with copyright. It's fair to say that the copyright law is a mess from the perspective of archival use and archival preservation. One reason for this mess is that although the archival community, through organizations such as SAA's Intellectual Properties Working Group, has defined the problems and sometimes developed very thoughtful solutions, those solutions have generally not found their way into legislative remedies. Indeed, I sometimes think we should just leave copyright law alone, because every time we touch it, it seems to get worse. Copyright terms become ever longer. Fair use is fairly dead. Effective preservation techniques in the digital era may well violate pre-digital copyright law. It is certainly true that there is work afoot in Washington to address many of these problems, and that some of that work comes from SAA. I applaud that work, and I applaud those that have done that work. But neither work afoot nor pending legislation is a law signed by the president. And as someone who learned his politics in a smoke-filled room in Detroit from some very serious union-backed politicians, rule number one was always not what was proposed, but what was passed. By that hard-nosed standard, we don't cut it. Privacy. Law after law is passed guaranteeing privacy without a short sentence or two, including the long view, that is our view, the archival view. Thus, this year, almost 30 years after the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, FERPA, was enacted, I wrote a first draft of a letter that Mark Green would eventually sign, addressed to the Department of Education, asking them to please, please put into the written guidelines issued by the department language making it clear that FERPA rights, like most other privacy rights, end with a person's death. This is not exactly a radical statement. And the Department of Education will tell you that this is the case. Quote, informally, end quote. Take that one to your legal counsel. After 30 years, the Department of Education still declines to put into its guidelines a sentence or two that would eliminate all sorts of problems for archivists who deal with student records. A friend of mine points out that SAA as an organization has never made this a high-level priority. And apparently, before this year, SAA hasn't even asked the department to change the FERPA guidelines. Maybe true. On the other hand, my first run-in with the Department of Education about FERPA occurred in the early 1980s. And I can't believe I'm the only archivist who has ever called the Department of Education, and this goes back so far, we didn't have email. I can't believe I'm the only person who has ever called the Department of Education and said, what gives? And request the department to clearly state that FERPA rights end when a person dies. Third, the public's right to government information. Think Executive Order 13233. John Dean described the impact of that executive order far more eloquently than I can, but for those of you who missed his description, through this stroke of presidential penmanship, signed November 1, 2001, the President's Record Act was stood on its head and made to serve purposes exactly opposite its intent. The consequences? Well, after 2006, the democratically controlled Congress has attempted to override the executive order, but the effort has been effectively bottled up in the Senate. I'm reminded that SAA has worked hard on this, indeed even played a role in organizing sufficient grassroots support to temporarily unbottle the legislation. Fair enough, and all actions I applaud and support. But equally fair to note, but almost 7 years after it was signed, EO 13223 is still the law of the land. And of course, there's PAR, or more formally, Preserving the American Historical Record Act. PAR is a $50 million dream, a serious chunk of federal change to support archives in the same way and with more or less the same dollars as the federal government has chosen to support both libraries and museums. I doubt I have to sell this audience on why archives deserve to receive PAR or how the money could be well spent. An order of magnitude greater than NHPRC, PAR could put real money in the pockets of real archivists all over the country. $50 million goes a long way, even these days. However, given our current political track record, it's hard for me to conceive of how we will get PAR passed. please understand that as with the other issues I've discussed and the other efforts I've noted, I have only the kindest words regarding the people who have conceived and put forward this legislation. They have done yeoman's work on behalf of all of us, and I am extremely grateful to each of them. But I confess, I am mystified that archivists believe doing political business the way we have done political business in the past can accomplish not only PARS authorizing legislation, but then winning the budget battles to actually fund the proposal. Recall some of the results of the traditional archival lobbying endeavors over the last few years. NHPRC unfunded for 4 years in a row in the president's budget as submitted to Congress, and historically underfunded when the congressional budget becomes law. Copyright legislation that is a true mess. Privacy legislation that does not reflect archival concerns. A president who 7 years ago, by the stroke of a pen, successfully changed what most archivists understood to be public records to become essentially private documents, and who, so far at least, is getting away with it. And I'm not even going to bring up Dick Cheney. Although I will tell you after the speech, I'm not going quail hunting with him. Somehow, continuing to do business in this way will lead to the passage of PAR and to its annual funding. I respectfully disagree. If we want PAR, if we want reasonable copyright legislation, if we want privacy legislation that reflects archival concerns, if overall what we wish to do is to see that our interests, archival interests, are more effectively represented in Washington, if we want this and much more, then we need to do our political business in a new way. We need to take advocacy to a new level and play politics more effectively. We need to learn from my old mentors in the United Automobile Workers, who preach two things: union solidarity and political presence. To put it slightly differently, we need to have our own lobbyist, and we need to unite ourselves to support his or her efforts on our behalf. Please understand, I don't claim that a lobbyist will solve all of our problems overnight, or even over a decade. The music lobby is still going to fight to copyright in seeming perpetuity every note from do to t and try to extend their rights back to do. The program officers at the Department of Education probably won't immediately pick up a pen and write in the language I would so much like to see in FERPA. President Bush probably will not suddenly become an advocate of the public's right to know. He may not even get a hint of what a public record is. A single lobbyist with many vested interests speaking in opposition to his or her voice or facing a hostile administration will not change everything, and indeed will likely fail to change some things. But a lobbyist, given a list of priorities that we create and given our united support, can do many things we do poorly or cannot do at all. They can monitor daily the issues we care most about, work regularly with the people in government that we need to work with, developing that face-to-face relationship so essential in Washington, speak regularly on behalf of archivists. Doing this will create a vast improvement in the likelihood of our success when compared to the current reality, where we have some shared voice with the National Coalition for History, and some archivists find some time to work on some issues. In the end, I suspect no one will likely disagree too much that better representation in Washington is an idea that has merit. Even those who believe in the capacity of the old system to succeed will likely agree with me that a lobbyist would be helpful in greasing the wheels of our older forms of political advocacy. The problem isn't that people will likely disagree about the advantages of having a lobbyist. The problem is how to pay for the lobbyist. Where could you find the kind of money you would need to hire you would need to hire a lobbyist in SAA's current budget? As the budget exists today, unless you wish to sacrifice either publications or education, you can't. And I don't wish to make such a sacrifice. Those programs are critical to the needs of our members. There is, however, another simple and elegant solution. Raise dues. You know, the funny thing was, I didn't think I was going to get much applause at that line. And I realize that the initial response to that suggestion is, fat chance, or something a bit more off color. SAA folk wisdom regarding a dues increase is that members don't like to do it, council hates to discuss it, and a president would have to be crazy to suggest it. I don't know about the first two pieces of folk wisdom, but as for the third, guilty as charged. I may be crazy, but the crazy thing is for a relatively small amount of money per member, we collectively could make the most significant change in archival political advocacy in a generation. For what is likely less than everyone in this room is going to spend on dinner this evening. And I know you're thinking it's San Francisco, it's an expensive city, God help us. Nevertheless, for less than you're going to spend on dinner, SAA could engage in a variety of needed activities. Earlier this week, at Mark Green's request, Council created a working group to assist Council in conducting political advocacy. It's my intention to ask that working group to list and prioritize SAA's political agenda for consideration by Council. To ask the working group to also develop a short but thoughtful paper regarding the cost of implementing that prioritized agenda. With that agenda and with that price tag, to ask Council to consider these reports prior to next year's annual meeting, with my intent being to ask Council to both endorse an agenda and a mechanism to pay for it, almost certainly a dues increase proposal. And unless Council simply votes the idea down, or there's a really bright person out there who comes up with a better idea other than a Ponzi scheme, they work to a certain extent, yes. To bring forward a resolution at the business meeting in Austin asking for a dues increase for the purpose of funding political advocacy. Friends too kind to call this crazy have said this is a quixotic vision, and that may be true. However, I truly believe that the vision foresees a plan which offers a practical and affordable solution to a persistent and fundamental problem. That Council, basing its decision on a thoughtful report from the working group, will share and support the plan, including the associated financial implications. That the membership will support the modest personal sacrifice to which they are called in order to advance our collective strategic interest in advocacy, a critical priority that represents a good for archivists, a good for the nation, and a good that can only be achieved by the National Association of Archivists. I truly believe that students will willingly invest in their professional future, that retirees will willingly help finance a legacy in which they can take pride, and that the rest of us will act to make the day-to-day practice of the profession take place in a more accommodating political and legal environment. I realize what I'm asking for is a deep change in the political culture of our profession generally, and this organization specifically, and that this change will be hard. But there's never an easy time to change. I realize if the economy is bad, and that some members are likely pinching pennies to make ends meet. But there's never a good time to ask for a dues increase. I realize I'm asking for a great deal. But we as a profession have a great deal to give to our society, to the culture and people who trust us to document their lives and ensure that that documentation is passed on and used by the next generation. It's our job. It's our duty. It's our calling. And as part of that job and that duty and that calling, it is our responsibility to ensure that the law of the land helps us do it better. Make no mistake, in the end, involvement in the political environment is not optional. It is fundamental to what we are called to do when we decided to become an archivist. It is part of the job. It is part of the duty. It is part of the calling. Well, let me conclude by asking you all to enjoy your evening, enjoy this lovely city, give the importance of political advocacy thought on the way home, not tonight. And to paraphrase that great Texan, Lyndon Baines Johnson, my fellow archivist, see y'all in Austin. Thank you and happy trails.
Bum ba dum ba dum ba dum ba dum ba dum ba dum. Happy trails to you until we meet again.
And as the SAA Chorale sings our
happy
trails
to you. Keep smiling until then.
Amy Felker and Ben McGunn to step to the podium. Keep going, chorus. Keep going. And I'd like to thank that fine chorale for what was the first and probably last performance of their career. Who's our spokesperson?
That, I guess I am. That's a long way away from Stevie Ray Vaughan is what I was promised. But I guess that'll do. I'm representing the program committee as the co-chair with Amy Felker. Where are you, Amy? Behind me here. And we are hoping to give you a very good program next year in Austin. Serving as the co-chair, we both got a chance to participate in the 2008 program committee and watched it develop from start to finish and did that in order to learn the ropes and in some way begin to anticipate some of the issues and ways in which themes change and technologies come around that help you do a better job at this meeting. And one of the things that we get to do is be assigned to, randomly assigned, to go into and proctor sessions and, you know, help out in any way we can, keep the door from shutting on somebody's fingers or look like we can be helpful when the lights go out and the microphone goes off. But, you know, you might wonder, when you get assigned a half dozen random sessions, what that's like. It's sort of like you can take a dart the next year's program and put the program schedule up on the wall and just throw six or seven darts at it and just go to those sessions, and that was what it was like for us. You know, I didn't know what to expect, and given that I wanted to go to some sessions of my own that I was interested in, I wasn't really looking forward to it, and I wasn't really keen on this, but the thing of it is, I found it really refreshing, because what it did is it created a schedule for me that really took me out of my comfort zone. And, you know, I was struck by a lot of the new initiatives and developments that are taking place in areas that are important to me, but just right now they didn't seem all that important, were in the back burner. And, you know, it was a little like I was getting educated for a change instead of updated. That was fun, and I didn't anticipate that. And, you know, through those sessions, it seemed that a thread of conversation emerged that I heard over and over again. And perhaps it was because I was in unfamiliar conversations. You know, as archivists, we've discovered, I think, a more poignant way of valuing relationships. I heard this over and over again. Next to our knowledge base, it seems to me those relationships with others, users or donors, resource allocators, IT professionals, I guess, emergency responders, colleagues, comrades of all kinds, are what really do enable us to gain authority in our workplaces, and with that authority, power, as Mark Green suggests we ought to grab it so correctly. It's what enables us, quite frankly, to grow our programs and ourselves in sustainable and lasting ways. So I've added relationships to the list of my core values, that they're heart of what it means to be a sustainable profession. And in part, I've done this to dramatize for you, in a small way, how you can take next year's theme and make it your own and interpret it in a way that works for all of us. Sustainable Archives 2009 in Austin is a chance for all of us to think about how we can do our profession better without degrading at all our essential strengths. In other words, to add value back into the mix that is going to be exciting in all kinds of new ways. Now, I want to just say five things that I want you to remember, because the call for proposals is printed in the back of your program booklet, and you should take a look at that, and I hope you have by now. So there's only five things that I want to say to you that are really important. We're going to be very pleased next year to co-sponsor this conference with the Council of State Archivists. And this is a great opportunity for all of us to find a different way to be exposed to government archives, and I think a great opportunity for them to work with us on this program to create, if possible, some cross-fertilization. Not only to have sessions on government archives, but perhaps about government archives and what it means to all of us as archivists. The second thing I want you to remember is to keep diversity always in front of you when you're coming up with your program proposals, and I hope you're all thinking of ways in which you can do that. It's really important that we pull in a wider, ever wider pool of perspectives to what we do, and to and the way to do that is when we go out to talk to people who we think would be great speakers or presenters on a program to get some commitment that this is the program they will do, and this is what they'll put their energy into. I want you to think that we are a global profession now. We have a global perspective. Bring international voices into your report in any way, and the committee will look very favorably upon that. October 8th is the deadline date. It's just around the corner, it seems to me. I know it is for me, and I'm sure for you all as well, after you get back and decompress from this trip. But try to be as complete as possible. We're going to attempt to do some new things in terms of how you submit your proposals. And so that brings me to the next point. You want to let us know absolutely immediately if you have any problem whatsoever in submitting your proposal. We're using an electronic form this year that's a little bit different. And it's all part of a slow but steady progress towards completely automating the system. But in that proposal and in your call for proposals is an email address, and you can sort of send us a question or a problem or a comment. I'll give either Amy or I a call, and we'll be happy to help you out. So, Amy, you got anything you want to add to that?
You've said it all.
I said it all. Okay. Well, look forward to seeing you. And now, our wonderful Brenda Gunn, chair of the host committee.
Chair of the host committee, Frank. Frank, I can work with you over the coming year on that you all problem you described, so that by the time you get to the opening plenary, y'all will come right out and you'll be proud of it. Okay, we can get that set up. We're so excited to have the meeting in Austin. I want to know how many people out here are excited to be coming to Austin. Woo! The conference hotel is the Hilton, and it's in downtown Austin. It's perfectly situated for all the things that I know these members love to do. It's half a block off our major 6th Street Entertainment District, which has fine food and theater and live music. We're four blocks from Lady Bird Lake, which used to be called Town Lake. It has a wonderful hike and bike trail around it. We're the same amount of distance from Ann Richards Bridge, which is home to the largest urban bat population in North America, which is very spectacular. And in August, the bats will be coming out very early in the evening, and so you can see these black ribbons emerge from under the bridge and stream over to the east for about 20 to 30 minutes. You can probably see that from our conference hotel, but we'll be definitely organizing trips down to the bridge so that you can get a closer look. And there's also a scent. It'll engage all your senses. That will. Also close to the hotel will be Zilker Park, which has the famed Barton Springs. And I know people are concerned about heat. We'll admit it. Austin is hot. We don't want to kid you about it. We're just going to get it out there. But you can go to Barton Springs, and at 68 degrees, you'll cool off really quickly. I'll be straight with you. If you miss this meeting, you'll regret it. And then here's the picture, here's the scenario for you. In future meetings, when you listen to your colleagues talk about that Austin meeting and how wonderful it was, you'll feel a sense of loss, and that regret will grow until you become, over time, a sad shell of your former self. So I want to save you from that. Make plans to come, and I don't want to leave you on such a downer, so we have a DVD which promises to show you all the wonderful things about Austin in a short 5 minutes. So let's see that.
Are you folks ready now? Are you ready to welcome back home one of your own, Lance Armstrong?
This is the greatest hometown in the whole world. I think it's the best place to be a citizen. It's the best place to be a bike rider. It's the best place to raise children. And the weather is always like this in August.
The music that echoes through its clubs, concert halls, parks, plazas, and even grocery stores, it's hard to define. Diverse in its culture, ethnicity, and politics, Austin embraces all of life's rhythms.
You don't have to be something you're not down in Austin.
Every major city has a skyline of towering monoliths. But Austin has something that transcends physical structures and material riches. This is a city with a heart and with a soul that ultimately define its unique character. The heart of Austin beats from a natural swimming hole, where a million gallons of water pump each hour, nourishing the city's lifeline. Barton Springs Pool bestows the town with its own eternal fountain of youth, a chilly 68-degree playground for cooling off on a summer's day. A seemingly endless artery of waterways courses through the city, bordered by miles of trails and green belts, and providing a home to millions of bats, whose flights create a nightly spectacle along the Congress Avenue Bridge. The soul of Austin lives in its music and creativity. From guitar legends and Grammy winners to hopeful rising stars, thousands of local artists find inspiration from the surrounding hills, the laid-back lifestyles, and the playful nature of a city where live music plays at more than 150 venues on any given evening.
I can feel myself a-falling.
Once content to remain a sleepy college town and home to the University of Texas, Austin is now all grown up. The same creative spirit that flows from nearly 50,000 students on the University of Texas campus emerged as a driving force to make Austin one of the country's great technology centers and home to some of the industry's most successful Fortune 500 corporations. A hot new destination in the conventions and meeting market, Austin offers more than 25,000 hotel rooms, with 5,500 of those convenient to the newly expanded convention center. Adjacent to the center is an 800-room headquarters hotel. The award-winning Austin Bergstrom International Airport is less than 10 miles from downtown. Inventive culinary offerings and eclectic shopping district show a cosmopolitan flair. Yet an unpretentious, down-home hospitality keeps the city rooted, even though its star is rising as one of the country's leading filmmaking centers.
The atmospheres and the locations are wonderful. You can make Austin look like anything, including Austin.
A thriving cultural scene and vibrant nightlife create an ideal environment for mixing business and pleasure. Quirky, eccentric, and far from ordinary, this is the kind of place where you check your worries at the city limit sign, trade in suits for something just a bit more casual, and prepare for experiences you'll find only in Austin.
I am told the plural of y'all is all y'all. So, all y'all, this beat and be done. See you in Austin.